Palmer, representing Bank of America in this case. Given my time limit, I really have only one fairly brief point to make. I'd also be happy to answer any questions the court may have. Otherwise, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. It would be probably something in the order of 6 minutes, I expect. My only point has to do with the retained earnings issue. We think this issue is pretty straightforward. As to retained earnings, this case is exactly like the home savings case that was decided by this court 2 years ago. In both cases, retained earnings replaced some of the regulatory capital that was lost as a result of the government's breach of contract. The court below held in this case that the cost of retained earnings was limited to common dividends actually paid in a year or two between the retention of earnings and the time that Thrift was sold to Bank of America. That resulted in zero damages because those dividends were outweighed by the proper offset that the court applied. And that's directly contrary to home savings. We made this point clearly, I think, in the bank's briefs. But one thing I'd like to add is a reference to this court's opinion on home savings that nails down the point that the cost of retained earnings isn't limited to dividends paid, but is the Thrift's cost of capital. At page 1354, this is at 399 F3rd, this court's home savings decision noted that the retained earnings damages in that case were based not on dividends paid, but, and here I'm quoting, on, quote, the rates the Thrift's investors would expect on retained earnings. That is the Thrift's cost of capital. So quite simply, home savings requires reversal of the decision below on retained earnings and a remand to reckon that court with the Court of Federal Claims to base its damages analysis on the Thrift's cost of capital and not on common dividends paid for the year or two before the bank was sold. At this point, unless the court has questions, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, may it please the court. I'm Michael Johnson, representing plaintiff appellants Dumanian Thrall. Your Honors, the realities of the Hanfed acquisition, as reflected in the documents and the uniform testimony, show that the trial court erred in holding that Dumanian Thrall lacked privity with the government. Dumanian Thrall made a written promise directly to the government to contribute $2.5 million of their personal assets to the Thrift under circumstances where the government would surely benefit. The promise was requested by the government, addressed to the government, and inured to the government's benefit. In every other decision where this court has addressed in the Winstar case investors making similar promises, they have been held to have standing as contract parties, Your Honors. Castle, SoCal, Blue Bond.
But do other cases have an instance where those parties also formed a holding group to negotiate the entire deal?
Yes, Your Honor. Castle and SoCal and Blue Bonnet each involved a holding company, and each involved a level where the shareholder was at the top, the holding company was interposed between the ultimate owner and the Thrift, and each of those involved promises running from the shareholder plaintiff, the investor plaintiff, to the government, and the government's reciprocal promises, although performance arguably would be rendered to the Thrift, ran to the investor. In each of these cases, the reality of the transaction was, as Mr. Falskridge testified in this case, the government dangled the forbearances to induce the investor plaintiffs, not a holding company that hadn't even been created yet, that had no capital, that had no track record, but to induce these particular prominent, successful, high-profile investors that the government concerted a coup to attract, and from whom the government insisted on receiving personal consideration from the investors to the government. In each of those cases, the investor plaintiffs were held to have standing to pursue their claims for damages. Now in this case, back in 2003, the trial court fashioned a special ad hoc rule that in order for a shareholder to be considered a party to the underlying transaction, the shareholder's participation not only must be essential to the transaction, but also must be acknowledged in the form of a written promise sought by and made directly to the government that is formally recognized to constitute part of the party's overall undertaking. Your Honors, no one can defend that standard today. It's simply wrong. I note, however, that even if it were right, we think we meet it. We executed a promise directly to the government that was unquestionably part of the overall transaction. But the trial court standard is simply wrong. The trial court erred, applying the wrong standard.
That's a question for me.
Of course.
This may be naive, but what liability do you think your clients would have had if they hadn't gone through whatever it was that they promised? That is, other than they wouldn't have had the benefit of this deal, what liability did they subject themselves to by their promise?
The government could have rescinded the deal, of course, if this were considered a material breach, and I think it would have been, given the import the government placed upon getting this consideration from the investors. I think we need to recognize that two days before the proposal was forwarded to the bank board for its consideration, the parties were still dickering about the contours of the investor plaintiff's promise to the government. We can see that in the letter from Mr. Frawl to Ms. Marshall of the bank board, and that appears at page 400160 in the appendix.
But you're not suggesting that your clients had any risk of personal liability for them?
Oh, certainly they did. That was what the guarantee put upon them, personal liability that they bore as contract parties that had they elected to remain mere shareholders, they in no sense would have borne. Their contractual commitment to the government allowed the government to come to them and say, Mr. Dumaney, Mr. Thrall, pay up an additional $2.5 million because you promised us you would under these circumstances.
They promised they would become guarantors.
That's correct, Your Honor. And at common law, a guarantee is sufficient consideration. The restatement of contracts treats it as a contingent promise, which is specifically acknowledged to be consideration for return promises. The restatement of surety and guarantee demonstrates that the most common arrangement for a guarantor is one in which he is in a contractual relationship with the obligee. In that case, the government and Dumaney and Thrall.
The Court of Federal Claims here found that all the obligations of your clients were owed to the holding company, not to on the Fed in the first place, on the Fed in the first place.
Your Honor, that's error that can't be supported by the evidence. We need only look directly to the bank board's resolution, not the testimony from the chairman of the bank board or the president of the Federal Home Loan Bank, each of whom testified clearly that they intended to and did make a contract with the investors. But the resolution, page 5 of resolution 86910, which is at A200183, there are two terms here that are important. First, the written personal guarantee, which we've already discussed. We'll come back to that in a moment, but let me also direct
that you're into your rebuttal time. You want to use it all now?
I'll reserve 1 minute, because I'd like to note that item 7 of the resolution specifically directs, it's addressed directly to the principals, and it mandates that they pledge their agreement to certain terms proposed by the government. Those are words of contract, Your Honor. The government directed them to Dumaney and Thrall. It sought their agreement, and Dumaney and Thrall provided it. And let me address briefly the guarantee letter. It is a financial commitment made directly from Dumaney and Thrall to the government. The government sought it. It's not addressed to the holding company, Your Honor. It's addressed to the government. Dumaney and Thrall signed it in their personal capacities. It could not be any more clear, Your Honors, that Dumaney and Thrall were making a promise directly to the government. They have standing as contract parties. This court should reverse the trial court's holding to the contrary. Thank you.
Mr. Pierce.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, as to Bank of America's appeal with respect to hypothetical cost for retained earnings, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in selecting an actual cost methodology to measure damages here. While we respectfully disagree with the rulings of Home Savings and LaSalle with respect to retained earnings, we recognize these are precedential here. Regardless, neither requires that the trial court's methodology be overturned. Home Savings dealt with an expectation of the dividends would be paid out in the future on retained earnings. Now, what Bank of America has pointed to is, well, there were three of those years of the 26-year period of retained earnings that had already elapsed, and they did not use an actual cost measurement for those 3 years. However, that was within the measure of discretion of the court. 23 of those years were in the future. It had to be an ex ante measure for those. As far as combining the 3 years that had already elapsed with that ex ante model instead of having a separate ex post model, that was within the discretion of the court. Bank of America also cites the trial court opinion will solve too, because part of the damages there were based upon dividends projected between the date of trial and 2012, the last year supervisor goodwill would have been held. However, the same sentence in LaSalle 2 notes that the damages model there was based upon the actual dividends paid between 1992 and 2005, supplemented by projections of dividends in the future. LaSalle 2 thus supports the damages methodology selected by the trial court here, that they use actual dividends paid for past years. Here, only 2.5 years of retained earnings were at issue. The amount of dividends actually paid by Han Fed and HFH for the retained earnings was known. The court did not abuse its discretion. With respect to the appeal of the shareholder plaintiffs, the trial court was not clearly erroneous in finding that Dumani and Thrall failed to demonstrate privity of contract with the government. As the resolution, the bank board resolution, the trial court found to constitute the contract addressed only promises between HFH and the government. Dumani and Thrall cite Levan, primarily cite Levan, Home Savings, and Caroline Hunt, but all are distinguishable on their facts. Moreover, these are the same identical shareholders whose claim of privity this court rejected in SoCal, and the same claim should be rejected here. Also, the concerns raised by this court in SoCal as to a double recovery by the shareholders and the corporation apply equally here. The HanFed and HFH shareholders were paid by Bank of America for the full value of their investment, except to the extent those payments were made to the Bishop Estate instead. And those payments to the Bishop Estate were the damages that Bank of America sought. Thus, any dilution damage to the shareholders by necessity would be the same damages that Bank of America sought here and would represent an impermissible double recovery. Now, with respect to Levan, as we've noted, that related quite heavily to the fact that the bank board resolutions named the acquirers expressly approved the transaction conditioned on their ownership of the thrift. Home Savings, the resolutions in that case referred to Amundsen as the acquiring entity. Caroline Hunt Trust Estate, this court noted the Federal Home Loan Bank Board's resolutions identified both Caroline Hunt and the thrifty stock incentive that applied for the approval as the applicants. And this court also noted the Bank Board's resolutions granted the regulators the authority to decide which applicant, Caroline Hunt or the thrift, would sign necessary documentations. Here the documents evidence that HFH was the applicant, that his application to acquire Han Fed was approved, and that all the obligations of the agreement were those of Han Fed, or of HFH. Now, with respect to statute of limitations, as to the statute of limitations, the trial court's legal conclusion in denying our motion to dismiss was an error. During the month of September 1989, Han Fed changed its plans from acquiring the first nationwide bank branches before raising capital to acquiring those branches after raising capital, or at the same time as raising capital, due to the government's breach. And BOA is now appealing a $2 million deposit it paid to extend the time to acquire those branches, an extension required by the government's breach. If the deposit was caused by the breach, then the breach was complete by September 14th, when Han Fed had informed regulators it was going to delay the branch transaction. Now, Bank of America asserted below that Han Fed and HFH's contract gave them permission to operate Han Fed with no tangible net worth. The record is clear that contrary to this contract that BOA asserts, the government began regulating Han Fed on the basis.
Is it the government's preferred position or position in this case that the act itself was the breach, as been held in three four circuits?
Yes, Your Honor. That is still our position, that three was the breach. However, we recognize that this circuit has held in the past that, or is not designated in the past, which of the three events they pointed to in Ariadne and Shane.
The question is open, isn't it?
What's that, Your Honor?
The issue is open here.
The issue is open here, Your Honor. And what we point to is not one of those three events. What we point to is the language in the trial court in Shane and Harry Edney that, in effect, the breach occurred when the government started regulating the basis other than of recognizing goodwill. And what we point to here is that in August and September of 1989, HONFED significantly exceeded then current capital regulations. They were tens of millions beyond the minimum, including the goodwill, the regulations that were in place at that point. Now, contrary to that, the Office of Credit Supervision used the new Korea tangible capital standards, one, to examine HONFED's application to acquire First Nationwide Bank's branches, two, to block the automatic approval of that transaction months before capital regulations changed, and three, to require HONFED to commit itself immediately to raising capital to meet Korea's tangible capital requirements months before the issuance of new capital regulations. Now, we also noted in our brief that HONFED and HFH immediately recognized this new state of affairs at HONFED. On August 31st, they notified the government that the FNB application needed to be resolved within the week or they would have to pull the plug on the transaction. The same day, they said their plan was to close on the FNB transaction by September 22nd and then to move on to raising capital. Now, their plan of closing by September 22nd is well within their parameter of closing the transaction by December 31st. Once they had changed that plan as a result of the government's breach, they obviously had to change the date if they wanted to continue with this transaction.
Is your position that the earlier chain in one of the cases that this court decided based on the facts that were presented there precludes this court from going into other circuits on whether the act itself was the...
No, Your Honor, it's still an open question, as you noted earlier.
Well, I know, but you're not hitting it very hard. Why is that?
No reason, Your Honor. With respect to the arguments
you
raised...
I would have thought that this would be an opportunity for the lawyer you did to present it squarely to us.
Your Honor, we did not address that in our brief. We just noted that our argument was still that Korea was the breach. With respect to the case law area in Shane that said the breach was the government's liability was fixed when it refused to allow use of the goodwill as it had promised, and also that the breach of contract claim accrued in area that he should have known that it had been harmed. That's the language we focus on, since that's the existing precedent of this court. And what we pointed to is clearly in September of 1989, well before September 29th of 1989, which was 6 years before they filed their complaint, HONFED and HFH knew not only that they were being regulated on the basis of their tangible capital and no longer had this contract that they asserted to the trial court of not being required to operate HONFED with tangible capital, but they also knew that because they had to change their plans, they had been harmed. Now, they could have dropped that transaction at that point. We do not agree that the deposit is a damage here. However, they clearly recognized at that point that they had been injured. Now, with respect to the tax gross-up issue, with respect to Bank of America's request for a tax gross-up, the trial court was not clearly erroneous in finding that Bank of America failed to demonstrate the taxability of the award here. Home Savings and LaSalle 3 merely indicate that the trial courts in both cases were not clearly erroneous in awarding a tax gross-up, and Bank of America failed to demonstrate taxability of the award here. In fact, the trial court in Home Savings said, quote, there's nothing to suggest that plaintiffs are not correct that the award will be taxable, and Home Savings found that to not be clearly erroneous. The trial court in LaSalle, after a discussion of case law, said it thought there was a possibility the award would not be taxed, but it didn't think it was a high possibility, so it awarded the gross-up. In LaSalle 3, this court concluded that it was not clearly erroneous that the damages award would most likely be subject to income taxation. In fact, the trial court here listed all the evidence and concluded, citing other trial court decisions, that BOA made a far less convincing case for the proposition that any such recovery would be taxed at all. We are thus unwilling to enter an award for damages that may never in fact come due. The government presented expert testimony that the damages being sought would not be taxable, and Bank of America's experts said they were merely assuming that an award would be taxable. Now, Bank of America's reply brief does assert at page 51 that the record below included extensive testimony to the effect that any award would be taxable. However, the only record citation that Bank of America was able to supply at that point was Bank of America's own statement to the IRS that Bank of America believed that an award would be taxable in full. And that's at A200665. However, Bank of America's statement that it thinks that an award will be taxable does not bind the IRS in interpreting the tax laws in a uniform manner and did not bind the trial court in evaluating the evidence. The trial court's conclusion that Bank of America did not prove that an award would be taxable is not clearly erroneous. Now, with respect to the liquidated dividend, the trial court clearly erred in awarding the so-called liquidated dividend as damages, where that dividend would have been paid in the absence of the breach. The undisputed evidence was that Bank of America did not want to acquire these problem properties, so the properties had to go to the shareholders in either a breach or a no-breach scenario. Bank of America has asserted that not including this liquidated dividend as damages is inconsistent with LaSalle 3. However, this court, LaSalle 3, approved the trial court's method of making a distinction for damages purposes between dividends that would have been paid anyway in a no-breach scenario and those that would not be. At 1335, quote, the court's modified damage model further reduced the cost of replacement capital award by the amount of dividends that Talman would have distributed to stockholders had there been no free-induced breach. And at 1336, the claim court did take into account but-for dividends. Here we have a liquidating dividend that would have been paid either way to the shareholders because Bank of America didn't want those properties. This court's opinion in LaSalle 3 thus supports excluding the liquidating dividend from damages. As the Bank of America's claim for the lost $2 million deposit, Bank of America asserts that it is just attacking the trial court's legal conclusion, but the trial court rejected this element of damages because it was unforeseeable and because causation was not demonstrated. So Bank of America must demonstrate that these findings were clearly erroneous. Bank of America has not been able to do so. I see the end of my rebuttal time, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. With respect to retained earnings, very briefly, the government has essentially one argument, as I heard Mr. Hughes, which is that what the lower court did was within its discretion. We would submit that inasmuch as there is no factual difference with respect to retained earnings between this case and Home Savings, no factual difference, Mr. Hughes hasn't pointed to any, that it is indeed an abuse of discretion or legal error, call it what you will, for the court below to have come out differently from Home Savings. We ask, in other words, simply that Home Savings govern the retained earnings issue. We think that that is all we need, and that that would produce the result that we see. On statute of limitations, Mr. Hughes somehow suggests that there was damage to HONTED, and indeed there had to be damage in order for the claim to accrue and the clock to begin ticking. Ariadne says that a plaintiff must know that it has been damaged by a breach of contract in order for the claim to accrue and the statute of limitations to begin to run. Well, what's the damage? What is the damage that occurred before October 6th? We know that if no damage occurred before October 6th, then the court below was correct.
You would need to know there was a breach.
I'm sorry?
You need to know there was a breach.
You need to know
damages
there was.
Damages may not have occurred yet.
Indeed, you need both.
There's an obligation to be damages, and ultimately you would probably figure out what they might be.
Agreed.
You're saying that to be what to look at and know what the damages are. know yet?
Has to be a breach, has to know what damages are. Hopefully we know what damages were as a result of the trial. That's part of what we're arguing about. But certainly before October 6th, there was no breach and no knowledge of damage. What is the breach? The breach, I'm not sure what it is. There was a postponement of a decision under a regulation that specifically said we can postpone our decision for 30 days. The government apparently suggests, though I don't know how they would do so seriously, that as soon as that occurred, HanFed should have come into court and said to the Court of Federal Claims, there has been a breach and we're damaged. They have to show both. If HanFed would have come into court before October 6, 1989 and made such an argument, it would have not passed the straight face test. 3 months later, in the flagship case, which we cited, 3 months later, after the regulations dealing with the new capital standards went into effect in December, after a bunch of other things that occurred, a thrift came into court and said, we've been damaged and we want an injunction against illegal conduct. And the court said, not right, not right. If HanFed had come in before October 6th, this very same thing would have occurred. The government would have defended as it did in flagship by saying, what's the damage? We haven't said you can't make this acquisition. And if the damage is that there's been a postponement, well, that's not damage at all. So we would have lost that issue had HanFed come into court before October 6th. On statute of limitations,
you said you would not have been able to use the goodwill as capital any longer.
We certainly did not know that until December 7th, because under the regime that governed under FIREA, HanFed, like all thrifts, had until December 7th to count all of its regulatory capital, and it did. And the decision to, even the October 6th decision to require that additional capital be obtained prior to approval of the acquisition, even that wasn't damaged. The testimony Mr. Hughes referred to the effect that September 22nd was a target date for the acquisition comes from a document in which the author, the president of HanFed, said, with a whole lot of luck, quote unquote, we hope to do the acquisition by September 22nd. I don't think that quite gets the government where it wants to go, particularly in light of contrary testimony, which we cite in our brief, by the CEO of HanFed, that even in the best of worlds, the acquisition would not have occurred until the last day of the quarter, September 30th. I may have misunderstood the questions from Your Honor to Mr. Hughes about statute of limitation, but certainly there is no circuit that has held that the statute began to run with the enactment of FIREA. If I've misunderstood the question, I apologize.
That's what logic other circuits have said.
They said, in the context, and the lower court here made this point pretty well, there have been statements and opinions in context which did not involve the statute of limitations. Statements in the course of an opinion dealing with other issues that the law changed when the statute was enacted. But that is not in the context of a case which is examining when a claim accrued for statute of limitations purposes. I think it's important to bear that in mind. The portion of the court's decision below that addressed that did a pretty good job. Liquidated dividend. The government has the burden of showing that that decision by the court below was clear error. I don't think it's done so. It was a dividend. It was all capital has a cost. This was a cost. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, you have a couple minutes. Your time is up as well. You divided up your time very strangely here, 1752. That's kind of wasteful, but I'll give you a couple minutes. But you used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm enormously grateful, and I'll be brief. Levan establishes that the ordinary standard, intent, consideration, authority, governs privity here. Carolyn Hunt establishes that that standard applies to shareholders without regard to the corporate relationship between them and any corporate entity, without regard to any contractual relationship between the government and their corporation. Your Honor, the government cites SoCal. In SoCal, this court held that Dumaney and Frall had standing. They had standing to pursue their claims against the government because they signed a capital guarantee, just like they did here. Now, that case is different because it involved two integrated agreements. And the terms of those agreements, one of which Dumaney and Frall were a party to, the other of which they weren't, certainly bore on the causation and foreseeability issues that governed the damages decision there. But damages aren't before this court. Dumaney and Frall haven't put on a damages case yet, and this court held unequivocally in Levan that it is error. It is error to conflate damages issues with standing issues. So, Your Honors, the trial court erred in holding that Dumaney and Frall lacked privity with the government. This court should reverse that holding, remand the case for determination of the damages the government owes Dumaney and Frall. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, with respect to the statute of limitations, we would note that with respect to the injury that's required for the statute of limitations to accrue, you just need to know that an injury has occurred. You don't have to have measured that or have an exact amount at that point. With respect to the accrual of this cause of action, in fact, on August 31st, we have the Confed people objecting that a new factual scenario is being plotted up, new capital requirements that did not exist at the time of their contract. They're complaining that they're going to have to pull the plug if this thing is not approved within roughly a week.
Which date is that?
That's August 31st, Your Honor.
Is that a response from the 28th?
It was a meeting held subsequent to August 28th. August 28th proposed some conditions, and there was a teleconference on August 31st. Now, also on August 31st, the government sent out a letter after they had this teleconference, or at the same time, in which it had been described that they were, in which it was described that basically they needed to accomplish this by September 22nd. The government came back and said, you know, it would have been automatically approved on September 5th, but we're going to extend it. And the only reason given for that extension was because that they failed to meet Perea's tangible capital standard. So our point is, Your Honor, is that the breach was effective either on August 31st or September 5th. Now, with respect to, see, my time is up. Based upon the previous briefings,
we gave them a couple of minutes to keep it fair here. You've got
Your Honor, cross-appellant, can I address shareholders briefly, or is that beyond the pale point of
view? You're still in the cross-appeal.
With respect to Bank of America's statement that what was the breach here? The breach was that HONFED, or Bank of America represented, that they had a contract where they did not have to have tangible capital operate this thrift. It was clear from the events of late August, September 1989, that contract was no longer in place. In fact, by September 14th, we have evidence that HONFED and HFH had already informed OTS they changed their plan. And the memo there by the regulators indicates that they are applying this rule across the board, that tangible capital for it must be met at this point. And they're judging applications on that basis at that point. By September 22nd, we've got an informal agreement, okay, we're gonna raise roughly $100 million before we acquire these branches. It's already in place. The formal letter hasn't gone out, but the point that we're making, Your Honor, is the breach was regulating them on the basis of the tangible capital standard of Korea, which started occurring on August 28th, and clearly it caused a breach no later than September 22nd. Now, with respect to our claims in general, based upon the previous briefing in this appeal and our arguments today, we respectfully request that our appeal be granted and our motion to strike non-record materials from the appendix and reference to those materials from Bank of America's briefs be granted. Thank you.
Your Honor, may I have 30 seconds to cite two pages of the appendix only that have not been cited in the briefs? I just want to refer the court to what they are. On the statute of limitations issue, the proposed conditions of August 28th.
Well, we're not going to have a new argument.
Okay. Page 400480 of the appendix shows that those conditions did not require HeinFed to comply with the new capital regulations. And page 200-30708 shows that the condition on the acquisition was based on safety and soundness rather than on the new capital regulations.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you.